you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 163 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today is kind of like reunion weekend. I have two of my favorite returning guest stars coming back to talk about a really interesting subject that I have been ignoring for a long time. So that's Brett Burney. I'm sure you recognize that name from his appearances on previous episodes of The Law Entrepreneur, and Chelsea Lambert, who similarly has been on before. The two of them teamed up to do a number of things, but most recently to produce the Electronic Discovery Buyer's Guide, a resource that you can take advantage of to get your arms around the problems of e-discovery. And as you'll hear in the show, e-discovery is something, frankly, that I have chosen to ignore because I didn't really understand it and didn't really see its applicability to the practice areas that I was in. But it's at a point now where to ignore the needs and requirements of e-discovery is something that you would do at your peril as an attorney, given recent changes in rules for professional conduct for attorneys. So I asked Brett and Chelsea if they could come on and talk about the subject and help educate me and hopefully you in the process, and talk a little bit about their work with respect to the buyer's guide. So this is a little longer episode than usual because there's so much to talk about, and I just enjoy talking with those two so much. So if need be, you may want to split this into two listening sessions, but nevertheless, I hope you enjoy and learn as much from this conversation as I did. And without any further delay, here are my good friends, Brett Burney and Chelsea Lambert. Brett Burney and Chelsea Lambert, welcome back to reunion weekend here on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. Yeah, thank you. It's always good to be back. I like that reunion weekend. It's good. Yeah. It makes me have flashbacks to like high school reunion, which is not a good thing, but this is even better.
My high school reunions are the best things I've ever done. So I would have to
okay.
I would have to dispute that gently here. But anyway, so Brett Burney, our returning champion, having appeared on the program on episode 23, episode 78. And episode 102, you entered the four-time guest appearance circle here with just a couple of other people. So you're pretty
I am much, truly honored.
That's pretty much wonderful. Tied for the lead. And Chelsea, we're having you back after a long absence. You were on the program on episode 92, and we're almost double that now. So welcome back. I'm glad to have you both. I'm going to dispense with introducing each of you and asking you to tell us a little about yourselves, because I'm going to direct our listeners to go back to episodes 23, 78, 92, and 102 to find out more about who you are and what you do. So I'm just going to ask each of you, what are you working on now that is exciting? Brett?
Oh, well, I'm going to let Chelsea jump in as well, because this is our second year now of providing an amazing resource. And I'll let Chelsea maybe talk a little bit about the history of it. But this resource is called the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide. And it is a free download that we created together, well, a little over a year ago, I think, Chelsea, and doing this. And it was based on a model that Chelsea had started doing with her company, Lex Tech Review, on the Legal Technology Buyer's Guide. So I'll let you take it from there, Chelsea.
Oh, thanks, Brett. Well, you know, it's Neil, we had talked, I think it was on the first episode together right after Lex Tech Review had come about.
Exactly.
Yep. It had wanted to write the Legal Technology Buyer's Guide. So, you know, 4 months and 180 pages later, you know, you feel like you had a child and it goes out into the world and everybody, is reading it. And then immediately they come back and tell you what's missing.
Yeah, exactly. So, what's wrong with your child?
Right, exactly. Which Brett and I had met, you know, at the Chicago Bar Association. He was, you know, by far the foremost expert and also one of the most passionate people about e-discovery and just really great to work with. And so one of the things that our audience identified was, you know, we're missing a piece on e-discovery. And I not only was exhausted after writing the first one, but I just couldn't wrap my head around it. I'm like, I'm not the best person to write that on my own. So I reached out to Brett and said, hey, you know, we're really seeing a need for this specific segment of products and services. I don't even know where to start. I'm like, but logistically, you know, I think if we team up, we can create something really special and really valuable. And we started talking about the need and the gap for resources around e-discovery, specifically for the solo to mid-size market, which is our core audience. And then that led to another edition, which is our legal operations field guide for e-discovery, which serves the in-house counsel and legal ops audience. So Brett and I, after last year, now will be technically on our fourth book together, which is really exciting when you think about it in just a short period of time. But the reception from our readers has been so heartwarming and so rewarding in that there really wasn't a definitive guide that explained to small and mid-sized firms what their options are. I mean, we both spend a lot of time speaking at conferences and serving the small to mid-sized law firm community. And there's just not a tremendous amount of education for that group on what their options are. So if they've seen e-discovery tools and services used in the big law environment, they don't know that there's also this other tier of products that they can use on a per case basis, that they can outsource their discovery if they'd like on a very cost-effective basis. So there's all of these solutions that, quite frankly, attorneys and their staff are just unaware of. So we've really poured our hearts and time and energy over those last couple of years into creating a resource. And also Brett moderates all of our webinars so that we can help educate. And we provide all of this for free to our readers. So well, we really try to bridge that gap.
Let me tell you, you know, the reason why I invited both of you on the show and to demonstrate my own ignorance is the fact that I think I'm the poster boy for your audience, a solo practitioner who has stuck his head in the sand regarding e-discovery for many years now. I mean, I frankly go to every conference and there's an e-discovery track and I'm like, oh my God, we're going to talk about e-discovery again. And, you know, I just, you know, through ignorance or willful neglect, I've, as I said, I frankly don't know why I should be paying attention or more realistically, at what risk of not paying attention am I? So tell me, you know, why should I care about e-discovery? I mean, I'm a bit of a reformed litigator. So I think my personal need is waning. However, I think it's probably increasing for everybody else. So why should we care about e-discovery? What's so important about it?
Brett, do you mind if I grab this one?
Go ahead.
Okay. So Brett has one of my favorite analogies that he uses is that if you were, you know, an investigator and you go to a crime scene and there was like a bloody knife laying on the ground, you wouldn't go and pick up the bloody knife with your bare hands, right? Because you're transferring your fingerprints, sure, you're tampering with the evidence. You know, there's all a long list of reasons why you wouldn't do that. Well, e-discovery is the same way. You see small and mid-sized firms, they get, you know, large amounts of data and files. And let's just take an email file, for example. So you need to go through hundreds of thousands potentially of documents or emails. And where do they do that? They open it up on their native computer, their laptop, inside their own Outlook account. And immediately, now you're transferring your digital fingerprints or your digital imprint onto those files. And that evidence is now tampered with. And you know, there's so many more forms of data now. You look at text messaging and video and audio files and physical documents. And so the volumes of data that we are creating that get wrapped up in a case or that need to be reviewed as part of as part of the e-discovery process, now there's just so many. And so there's so many tools available to you to do that. And Brett, I'll hand it over to you to take the rest of this explanation. But I love that analogy so much because it really kind of like, it wakes you up to how significant opening something as simple as an email file in your own Outlook account could be to the end result of the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I use that constantly and just kind of helping people sort of get their head wrapped around this idea of why some of this is even critical and important to think about. I even maybe take a step back. And frankly, I realize a lot of time I'm sensitive to the fact that unless you are a litigator that is dealing with matters day in and day out, yeah, you're probably not going to have to deal with e-discovery. Or frankly, I have a lot of clients that have just been able to avoid it, either because they intentionally distract themselves or opposing counsel, not pointing any fingers, Neil.
Yeah.
But you know, they just distract them. And it's like saying, you know what? Let's not even go there. Like, I'm not going to ask for the electronic files of the email if you don't, right? Let's just agree to like, print them out and we'll send them to each other or something like that.
Well, that's 100% correct. And I was going to say, you know, one of the ways that I avoided the issue is in family law, when I was doing more family law, you know, there's a lot of evidence in emails and text messages. And my clients would come in with printouts of email messages or screenshots of the text messages. And I would just tell them, look, we're going to have to establish this fact pattern some other way, because I don't want to have to go through the time and expense of being able to introduce or trying to introduce this as evidence, because I don't know how you produced it or how it came about. So,
right.
So now I'm compromising my ability to some extent because of my lack of understanding of what e-discovery requires and means.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the way I go about it, just to give people sort of a framework in what it says, similar to what Chelsea was just saying. Every piece of information that we deal with today, and by the way, I'm not just talking about civil litigation, because frankly, when I talk about e-discovery, a lot of people turn me off because, well, you know, we don't have big corporate clients, so we don't have to deal with that. It doesn't matter what you deal with. You just said it, Neil, excellently. Even in domestic issues, right? Criminal law, construction law, real estate, it doesn't matter what we're talking about today. You are dealing with electronic information. All information is electronic today, right? Save for a handwritten note on a yellow legal pad or some kind of legacy type information like microfiche or something. Everything we deal with today is electronic in nature. Now, I'm making a broad generalization here, but if you hold a piece of paper in your hand that is a document, you know that somebody didn't go and handwrite that document, or frankly, well, hopefully nobody still used an IBM Selectric typewriter to create that. You know that document came from where? It came from a computer, right?
Somebody's.
And they used Microsoft Word to create that computer, or they created a PDF or a text file, or it's an email that was actually printed out. The point is, the original file of all of that information is not the paper version, right? The original file is the electronic version. Now, I'm not, I don't hate paper, right? Yeah. I try to be sensitive and practical to the fact that, yes, I completely understand that there is always still going to be a need for paper. But when it comes to the discovery part of investigating information about those files, the only way you're going to get all the information that you are due is to look at the original file. We all know about in Microsoft Word, you can go to file properties, right? And you can see all kinds of information about that document. Who was the original author? When was it last opened? When was it last printed? How many words are involved in this? When was the last time that it was modified or changed? How many edits were made to this Microsoft Word document? All of that information is there. That's what we know as metadata, right?
Right.
All that information is there. When you print that Word document, guess what? None of that information is available, right? Same thing with email. In an electronic email message, we have dozens of fields of metadata that talks about not just when it was sent or received, but whether it was a BCC to somebody, whether it was even opened or not. That's something that you don't necessarily know inside a printed document. Presumably it was open, of course. But there's other information about like what conversation or email thread that message belonged to and how many attachments that you have. When you print an email message off, you don't get that. Now, we understand kind of this idea of a Microsoft Word document. When we try to define a document today, a Microsoft Word document we know is a document or a PDF file. That's an easy stretch.
Sure.
But then I always show a picture a lot of times in my CLEs of an Excel spreadsheet. Have you ever gone through the horrendous nightmare of printing an Excel spreadsheet, right? I get so many people that are frustrated with this, Chelsea, that I talk about this because, you know, if you've got five columns on a spreadsheet and you print it out, what happens? You got four columns on one page, right? And the fifth column prints on the next page. And then you got to like cut it all out and scotch tape it all together.
And 40 I always sheets ask, of blank paper.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I always ask the room that I'm speaking to, why is this a problem? Why does this happen? And the answer is, frankly, because an Excel spreadsheet is not meant to be printed, right? An Excel spreadsheet is meant to be viewed in a spreadsheet program. Same thing like with a Microsoft PowerPoint file or the examples Chelsea was just giving. A text message, for example, why is that so hard to preserve? Because it's not meant to be printed or it's not meant to be something that we do in a screenshot, right? And even, frankly, email today, Neil, is not meant to be viewed in a silo, right? We treat email today as a way that we have a conversation, for example. So if you just print one email out, you are literally losing the context in where you are replying to somebody or forwarding an email message. Anyway, hopefully that just gives someone...
And we see that all the time in family law where somebody has presented, you know, one email message out of a thread to present a specific point, only to be then countered, hey, but Your Honor, they didn't show the rest of that thread. Let me show you, you know, the others. And so, I mean, your point is well taken in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and sometimes we can print, you know, that when you print an email, which by the way, there's no pages in an email message, right? When we look at an email, we just continue to scroll down, scroll down, scroll down. The only time that there's a quote page in an email is when we do one thing, and that is print it out or convert it to PDF, which is pretty much the same thing. But it's like you may have the rest of the conversation in that one email conversation in that email that you print out. But the only way you're going to know about the other messages that are involved is if you get the original electronic file. There's no other way. And in that case, that's what Chelsea was referring to. In some cases, we need the what we call the native electronic file, the native file, which is not a PDF of the email message. It can be, and I'm not saying that that is never good enough. It can be. But in most cases, if we have any kind of a doubt, it's exactly what you were just referring to, Neil, that we want to see all of the information about it, we need the native electronic file. And in many cases, that means going into either an email server or somebody's email software and exporting out a collection of those email messages. And many times, because of Microsoft Outlook and the prevalence of that software, we will convert it out into what we call a PST file. PST file. So if anyone's ever done any discovery, you probably have heard about a PST file. It stands for Portable Storage Table, but it's basically just the file format that can contain one email message or it can contain 10 million email messages. A PST file is just a file that basically keeps all of the metadata intact about email. And it's just those kind of things like that. And I know a lot of people probably just turned it off when we try to get a little too geeky there.
But no, I think on the contrary, what it's doing, yeah. What it does for me is it helps me crystallize in my mind what the end result here is. Because, yeah. I mean, I think we all have a visceral understanding of what an email message is or an email thread. But if you said to me before this conversation, how would I introduce one of those messages or all of that thread? How would I, in response to a discovery request, provide that? And then, subsequently, how would I then introduce that at trial?
Yeah.
And so now you're raising some questions in my mind. So this PST file, as an example, would then have to be delivered on an electronic medium.
Right. Yes.
And then you have to use some other type of tool to then present it in context, as part of your argument.
Absolutely. You're right on it.
Okay.
And let me just say quickly, I would say just based on your questions, because Neil, you represent a lot of folks out there in the sense that, how do I present this? How do I put this basically into a package that we're familiar with, which frankly comes down to a document, right? And I would just say that's not your fault or the fault of many other practitioners, because it's not really like some of the procedural rules have kept track with the way that we are dealing with information today, right? Yeah. Now, I say that, but even in 2006, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and since then, many of the state rules of civil procedure have been amended to include this phrase, electronically stored information. Even in Rule 34 of the Federal Rules, for example, it said producing documents and tangible things. And so in 2006, we had that phrase, electronically stored information, to be added to that. But it was more of a recognition, I think, of the fact that, yes, we are making sure that we are including a lot of additional information now in the way that that society, frankly, stores information. But you have some very specific questions, Neil, that frankly, it's not easy to do, right? Even if you came to a comfort level, Neil, with getting the PST file, using some of the tools, which is what we go through in the buyer's guide, using the tools to review the PST and understand the PST, the other side may have no clue what you're talking about, right? I get that all the time.
Yeah.
And that's extremely frustrating, because even if you, Neil, or an individual came to a comfort level with how to deal with this, what we're still finding is frankly, the other side just kind of looks at you with a blank stare, or even worse sometimes,
the
judge just says, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Now, you're not going to get that at the federal level much anymore today. The federal judiciary has done a very good job of educating a lot of especially their magistrate judges over the last few years on doing this. But certainly, I continue to see this in state courts, even though the state rules have been amended to acknowledge this from a logistical procedural standpoint. Your questions are extremely valid, Neil, just because people just haven't encountered it enough to have a comfort level with it.
Today, I'd like to introduce a new sponsor to The Law Entrepreneur, and that's the folks at Jurisdiction. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150. That's like the Law Entrepreneur 150 for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to run my practice. If you want to take your practice further, you need to try Daylight. Daylight keeps track of every case detail and reminds you when you need to follow up so you can focus on what matters most. To be honest with you, I can't imagine running my practice without Daylight. So say hello to a stress-free workflow and visit marketcircle.com to try Daylight now. Remember to mention that you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount off your first monthly subscription. Well, let me ask Chelsea this question, kind of circling back to really the overall objective, because it's not clear to me, or maybe I have a preconceived notion. Is the point of this, to provide the resources to legitimize the validity of the e-document or the electronic data, or maybe it's an and-or, is it to get the additional information about the generation of that piece of data that might assist me in my case?
So, in my personal experience, and I've sat in on Brett's sessions, and I've also discussed this by teaching tech sessions in a group environment, like a retreat or beyond conferences, where really we're working on one-on-one issues within the firm, that there is a lack of knowledge around the specific use cases where it would necessitate using a piece of technology. So the best way that I can explain it, and the attorneys that I've discussed this with, they feel like they know that there's something out there. They're overwhelmed by the amount of work that they have to do because they've been doing it manually. And they feel like they're working with one hand tied behind their back, but they don't know. It's kind of demystifying. The books are intended to demystify the misconceptions that people have around when I'm supposed to use it, how big does a case need to be, what kind of data sets should I be paying attention to, and these are the solutions that are available to you in a price point that's very manageable. I mean, I'll give you an example. I happen to have a copy, which we don't technically print them, but we like to carry a copy of the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide around with me. I was doing a law firm retreat in Georgia, and they're going through this problem where they feel like the litigation department, that practice group, was really handicapped in their ability to serve clients and handle specific cases, because they know, okay, I've heard about e-discovery. It's this big, scary word. You know, they see big price tags around it. They're not really sure. So they just don't have the time to investigate that. They're busy serving their clients. And they say, I don't know what I should be using or when it makes sense or how much we're going to spend. So they don't even know how to make that case or have that conversation within the firm. They just know that it's a pain point and it's very frustrating. So I pulled a book out of my bag. I walk over, I hand it to them. And it was like the look on his face was like, you know, just the light came on. And that now all of a sudden there's essentially a shopper's handbook of when to use it. Articles from thought leaders explaining certain situations, explaining the transition. We're in a very different place in the e-discovery landscape today than we were 10 or 20 years ago, because now with the advent of SaaS solutions, the ability to store massive amounts of data at a very inexpensive cost on the provider side. You know, if 10, 20 years ago you said, oh, I need, you know, a few terabytes of data, people would look at you like you're crazy and like you better go put another rack in your server room to handle one case. And we all know the tens of thousands of dollars that used to come with that decision, not to mention the IT bill that you're going to get afterwards. So I think the ability for organizations to scale up very quickly from a technical perspective by either leveraging cloud-based tools or by using some of the services and products that are available on a per-case basis. So they've become this perfect storm of there being a need, in that so much more evidence is electronic now. You're not dealing with you still have bankers' boxes full of documents, but a lot of that is, here's your hard drives, here's the electronic storage devices, and go ahead and get to work. It wasn't always that accessible. You see the way that the medical industry has transitioned over the last 10 or 20 years of moving to electronic medical records, HIPAA compliance, all of the things that have happened in that industry. You're now seeing similar patterns come to happen within the legal space of really transitioning not to paperless offices, but for the documents and the files and the evidence and the data involved in working through a case, litigation and non-litigation, is now moving all within that electronic format. So it's just it's a different need that is part of everyday life now that wasn't previously.
It's interesting that you referenced medical records, because I've seen over the course of time, again, drawing on personal experience, when I used to do personal injury work, when in order to introduce medical records, they have to be certified, or you have to have an expert who can testify to the content of those records. But the same hasn't held true largely in terms of that validation aspect of it with respect to other electronic data, such as emails and text messages and the like. Are we, through this e-discovery process, are we getting closer to that aspect that type of treatment, or is it going to be something different because we have these tools and case sets that are uniform that can be taken into account and understood by a court?
Yeah, great question. I would say maybe a close analogy that we already deal with from that aspect, from like authenticating basically a copy of some information that we get from a computer. Let me just throw out a couple of other, they're going to sound like geeky terms, but like we've already been talking about, Neil, you're able to follow this and sort of look at the big picture. In fact, I've just been working with another matter where the question was whether an individual received an email about a year and a half ago, right? So how do we find that answer based on, we can go and talk to the individual, right? Did you remember getting this email? No, I never got this email. Well, the first thing we could do then next is we could go to their computer and we can look and do a search in their Microsoft Outlook and see, did they ever have that email? Of course, we don't know if they deleted it, 6 months ago and they don't remember, whatever the case may be. So the next step that we could go to then is we could do what we call a forensic image of that computer. And it's basically a copy of the computer or the hard drive, if you will, not the kind of copy that we do when we go to our computer desktop and we copy one file from one folder to another folder. This is a very low level copy, and low level by what I mean by that is we copy all of the kind of information on there. And when we make that copy, it usually is done by a professional computer forensic examiner that is certified to be able to do this. And they make that copy. And once they do that, they can then certify that this copy was made at a specific date and time. And then from that point forward, we have that copy that can be basically authenticated in court, wherever the case may be. There are two main tools for this. There's several others, but the two main tools that people may have heard about is EnCase, E-N-C-A-S-E, and another one called FTK, Forensic Toolkit, from a company called Access Data. But we can basically use that then to say, well, okay, we've gone through, we've searched it, we've even searched things that were deleted, and we can verify that what we found here, or maybe what we didn't find here, is it doesn't exist, right? In other words, we can show that this file came from this time. The last time somebody opened it was exactly this date. The last time somebody made a change to it was exactly this date. And so those are sometimes the kinds of questions that we're looking for. So I know that's a little bit different than what you were asking for.
No, I think I think it's on point. And I think that helps our listeners, and it certainly helps me understand, you know, what that process is and how this whole conversation of e-discovery plays into it. So
Well, and I was just going to quickly say, you know, we borrow sort of from the criminal side on this, Neil. We call it the chain of custody.
Yeah.
And in some cases, even if we don't do a forensic image of a computer, in some cases, I might just go to an individual custodian, is what we call them, a person, and you know, a company employee, whatever the case may be. And maybe they do copy that file, the typical way that we do a copy of a file onto a thumb drive or something to send it to me so that I can examine the file, which, by the way, at that point when they do that, they are making changes to the metadata of that file, which in some cases may be just fine as long as we know that. But we also have to be able to follow exactly who made the copy, when it was last opened, who opened it. I run into firms all the time, Neil, that, you know, they get a bunch of Word documents or even PST email files or PDFs from maybe one of their clients, and they think, well, okay, it's a Word document, so I'm going to open it up in my Microsoft Word file. Or Chelsea mentioned earlier, I've got a bunch of email, and of course, email opens in Microsoft Outlook. I've got Microsoft Outlook. I'm going to open it right in Microsoft Outlook. When you do that, just exactly what Chelsea described earlier, you are literally opening and putting your digital fingerprints on those files. And the way I talk about it, a lot of people can relate to this. If you open up a client's email in your own Microsoft Outlook, in other words, you are commingling electronic evidence with your work product. That's my favorite word to use. You're commingling there. When you print out that email message, whose name is at the very top of that printout? It's your name. It's not the client's name, right? I worked with one firm that they were telling me, we keep having to produce these emails. You know, we got emails from our client. We need to produce them to the other side, but we keep having the attorney's name at the top of the email. Turns out they were opening them in their own Microsoft Outlook. Well, again, you've got your fingerprints on it. There is no way to make those changes. And then just quickly, that's what Chelsea was talking about earlier with the buyer's guide. There are some of these tools out there now that preserves the metadata.
So there are tools then that allow you to put on the rubber gloves so you can handle bloody knife.
Exactly. I like that. I wasn't quite going to the rubber glove side, but that's fine. I got you. Where are you going with that? Yes.
Imagine it, you know, like a clean room. You know, just in the same way where you're bringing data into a very clean environment, that's really what these solutions do. They put it in a place where it's segmented and held in an area where, and then you have incredibly powerful search and organizational tools. The email threading, I know Brett, you're always so excited when you see that in a demo. And now the application and use of artificial intelligence and machine learning, where think about how different it is today than it was years ago, of instead of having to parse through email by email, document by document, with the advent of an application of AI and machine learning and things like neuro-linguistic programming and the ability to see patterns within a document or a conversation, as opposed to it just being words that they're searching for, you're able to get to what you're looking for faster. So it's really streamlining and reducing the amount of time associated with discovery so that you can more efficiently serve your client and also not spend months parsing through data.
Well, that's a really important point, because I think, you know, my fear has always been is that if I start, you know, being more proactive and more diligent about getting the whole e-discovery picture together and starting to use that as data in my cases, I'm now quadrupling or exponentially increasing the amount of data that I have to work with. And now what does that do for me in terms of my workflow? You know, I was being buried by paper before, and now I'm just suffocating under electronic data. But you're suggesting, or not even suggesting, stating that advances in being able to work with that data in a clean room environment to protect its sanctity is such that you actually can do it faster and more efficiently and more effectively than you could if you had a mountain of paper in a banker's box.
I would absolutely say that is correct. In fact, I would say if we have a client that sends their entire inbox, let's just pick on you again, Neil.
Yeah.
One of your clients sends you their entire inbox because you need to find some of the relevant messages, right? Because they don't want to take time to go through their inbox and only send you the relevant messages, right? You'd rather they do that. But you now have to do that. So if they send you their entire inbox, and we know everybody's inbox is just overwhelming, what are you going to do? Are you going to start at the top and go one by one by one by one and try to decide each one of those, whether or not they're relevant, or using exactly the tools Chelsea was just talking about, which we're now seeing to be embedded in this? Some of these tools now can go through and look at this information, and you can say, you know what, here's one of the really important emails, and you can show that to the tool, the software. We call this predictive coding or technology assisted review. Now, this is really getting a little high geeky, but just like anything else, this is absolutely trickling down into some of these tools. Or you can give some words or searches, because we all know about keyword searches. You can give some of those words to this tool and say, you know what? You go out, software tool, and you make a determination quickly on showing me what is going to be some of the more relevant messages than not. I'm not going to delete the rest of them, right? I know this freaks out a lot of attorneys because they're like, well, my responsibility is I've got to look at everything. Well, that is starting to change. It is, and we see this at many, many different levels today in a lot of e-discovery opinions, because there's a lot of substantive law around this now, that you don't have to look at everything. In fact, to take a conservative number, Neil, if somebody were to send you their entire inbox, at least 80% of that is going to be completely irrelevant. And if you are spending that much time looking at some of those irrelevant messages, then you've obviously wasted not only your time, you're overwhelmed, but you've wasted the client's time. Now, I'm not saying all these tools are perfect. And I, you know, a lot of people say, well, how do I know that it's getting me what I really should be looking at? If it can just at least give you a starting point, right? And if it can go through, because these tools are getting so much better. And we see this all over the place. Like doing a Google search. You remember doing a Google search, you know, 5-10 years ago? How much better is that now? Same kind of technology is being embedded into this, or even doing a search on Westlaw or Lexis. And if these tools can at least give you a good starting point to say, we're going to leave the rest 80% over here, but you know what? Start with this 20%, because we can tell you that this group here is going to be more relevant than the rest of it. If you need to go back to the 80% later, you can always do that. But we're willing to bet you're going to find what you really need, probably in this 20% pile over here.
Well, you've convinced me of now the need to pay attention to the issue. I guess I can't stick my head in the sand anymore. But maybe I can restructure my practice to avoid it. So is there a particular practice area that this is more critical to, or one that it is almost not applicable at all? Or is there some aspect of a matter or some types of matters that should be considering e-discovery or not? Or is the answer all the above?
Well, the answer is all of the above. I know that's the easy answer and that's a short answer. And of course, you know, you're talking with somebody that is a little bit nerdy on this kind of information. So again, I try to be practical. And I think I alluded to this earlier that we used to think of e-discovery
as criminal. Yeah.
First of all, just for the big firms, just for the big civil litigation matters, you know, just for federal court, like I'm not doing any of that. I'm focusing on my little corner of the world right here. You know, I've got small clients with small claims and small issues, and that's all fine. Except again, you cannot get away from the fact today that in almost any matter that you're dealing with, criminal, domestic, civil litigation, real estate, any question that you have today, you are having to look at information. That's what we do as legal professionals. We have to investigate information. And what is information today? All information today is electronic. if you have a printed version, there still is an electronic version somewhere that is being, whether you need social media, that's a huge thing today, of course, right? I used to say, it's amazing what people will say in an email message. I always looked at it as job security because I cannot tell you how many times we have found an email message where somebody has put down in words something they would never say to the person face to face. They would never pick up a phone and call somebody and say this to their face. Yeah. But yet they will put it down in a medium that will probably never be deleted. Because if you send that to somebody, many, many cases have happened this, that the sender may not still have the email, but they sent it to somebody and then that person was offended. So what do? They sent it to somebody else, right? There are copies everywhere. It just is amazing to me what people will put down in an email message. But it's the crux of many,
even more
many
so
matters.
With social media, though, right?
There you go. Until Facebook came along. And it is amazing what people will post. You know, for example, here's a quick little, we usually think that employment, you know, discrimination or personal injury issues, right? Your client is maybe an individual that claims that they were hurt on the job and they have a legitimate claim. The other side's a huge company with a big firm, of course. And your client claims, I couldn't walk. This is actually a case from Western Pennsylvania that they got injured from a forklift. So they can't enjoy their life anymore. They're embarrassed. So they can never wear shorts again. But of course, what pictures are posted on their Facebook? They're in shorts. In fact, I remember this phrase from this opinion was they had pictures of them riding and stunting on four-wheelers and motorcycles. So they were able to enjoy all the same things. And, you know, they claimed one thing in court, but then they posted something. And in fact, in that particular case, the court said, based on the public pictures, we're going to let you get into the private side of their Facebook profile because you jumped over the burden of being able to show us that there's enough information that can even be put into the private side. So again, things like that we never would have possibly thought about or considered from the beginning, but today those are actual realities. And that, like, so it doesn't really matter what kind of a matter of a case or an issue that you're dealing with today. If you're having to find information somewhere, it's going to be electronic. You may not always keep it in e-discovery. You may not call it e-discovery, but it's electronic information that you need to look at and to parse through.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Well, in the time that we have remaining, let's now get to the really sexy stuff, okay? The thing that turns nerds on, like the three of us. So Chelsea, what's the one thing that attorneys can do to get ready for addressing e-discovery, and what are the tools? And what, we've already talked about the buyer's guide. I want to talk about that a little bit more, but what are some of the things that we can get our hands on to prepare ourselves for this and to start to address it? And what are some of the tools that make life easier?
So I think that, you know, there's very much an awareness that's building in the community, especially given, you know, ABA's, the release of the recent ABA opinion 477, that it is your professional duty and obligation to your clients to be aware of what's available to you. So there are thought leaders like Brett and publications like the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide and Craig Ball is and Tom O'Connor and a lot of the contributors that we've had to the series that you can follow on social media or subscribe to updates from their blog. And so by at least being aware of what solutions are available in the marketplace, noteworthy cases where specific types of evidence have been used, whether that's harvested from social media or messaging or video, or now 2019 is the first edition that we've had, Brett, where we have an audio file section, right, which is really interesting. And you know, the one thing that I would just say is that don't get so caught up in all the buzzwords of AI and machine learning. Yes. Here's the reality of this is that AI and machine learning have been part of our daily lives for a long time. Okay. Right. So when you see solutions that are implementing AI and machine, this is now the norm, not the exception. So just know that that is very much a part of nearly every piece of technology that's on the market now in one way or another. They're using smart technology, self-learning technology to improve their products on a regular basis, or help have the client train the software how to perform better. So to answer your question, one, be aware by subscribing to relevant news, following publications that are relevant to your practice area, the type of law that you practice, the cases that you serve, the clients that you serve, so that you know what is happening in the marketplace. And then two, seek out a solution that fits how you work. And from a trainer's perspective, yeah, I always take this approach of you can buy all the technology in the world, but if you don't know how to use it, or it's not something that you see value in every day, all of your money is wasted. So find a solution that feels like home, that feels like it solves a problem or a pain point for yourself or your clients, because you will value it much more and you will use it on a regular basis. You can buy a really, really expensive car, but if you don't know how, you know, a sports car, and if you don't know how to drive stick, you're never going to take it out of the garage, right? So it's important for you to know that you're going to use it on a daily basis. And I've seen so many implementations where, you know, they buy the Cadillac of software, and then you walk in the office and like people have maybe logged in like once. And you always know that pattern because nobody ever knows their passwords, because the last time they use it, or their usernames, or, you know, anything. Well, so when was the last time that you logged in or actually used this? I don't even remember. Okay, well, now we're going to have to retrain and restart all over again. So it very much goes, the one point that I would drive home is not just being aware of what's available to you in the marketplace, that if you make a decision to invest in a solution, be sure that it's something that's going to work for you in daily life.
Well, come on, Chelsea. If you get rid of my shiny object syndrome, I'll own nothing. What am I going to spend all my money on?
Oh, what's my Apple? We keep Apple in business. That's for sure.
before I lob this softball into Brett's wheelhouse here, you're really telling me that I'm going to have to stop skipping the articles about e-discovery in the local bar journals.
There's a balance there between, you know, we recognize, and again, another driver for publishing the book was, we wholeheartedly understand that the everyday practicing attorney is not the legal tech nerd, you know, like the three of us on the podcast right now, you know, that sit around like all day. I've spent the last 14 years of my life like investigating every solution out there and demoing every product and writing about it. And, you know, so that's not normal. That is the career that I've chosen. That is what I love to do. That's what we're passionate about. We realize that that's not realistic for someone who's practicing law. You're serving clients, you're getting, working on, you know, business development activities, bringing new business into the door. So that's really why we've tried to provide you with a distilled version on an annual basis of, hey, this is what's new, here's what's out there. And if all you have is 5 minutes, go to the YouTube channel and watch a few of Brett's videos. That's one of the reasons Brett came up with this idea this year that I love, of doing these highlight summaries of the reviews, of just, hey, you know, this is an overview of the review, this is the overview of the product. Go ahead, and if it's enticing to you, or you find that it's speaking to a particular pain point, go ahead and read the full review. Of course, we encourage you to do that, but we recognize that people don't have a tremendous amount of time. And our readers have come back and cited that it saves between 30 and 100 hours of research, because a lot of the solutions that you'll find in the publication are ones that you may have never heard of. And that was our goal from day one.
Well, we're going to talk about how to get the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide here in a moment. But Brett, I want to give you the opportunity to flex your muscles here a little bit and give us just kind of a synopsis of maybe a couple of a few of the tools that we might want to start paying attention to. I will confess that the sole extent of my knowledge of anything having to do with eDiscovery-like issues is Page Vault. And that's, and I really, I understand that only at the surface level. So if you could kind of give us kind of a little bit of an overview of a couple of three to tools to kind of whet our appetite, and then we can go to the buyer's guide to find out all we need to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am thrilled. I mean, I let me say it, of course, like this. I hate to point out certain tools because there's always a couple of others. And I know sometimes people get a little upset if I don't mention that, but here are some highlights. You already got one of the main ones, Neil, Page Vault. I'm a big fan of this company. They're based out of Chicago. And basically they solve that question that we've alluded to several times already. And I need to capture this person's Facebook profile, or I've got this Twitter conversation that somebody was having with one of my clients, and I need to collect and preserve that entire conversation. Or I've got a website here where, you know, the defendant, big large company, said something on their website, but then, you know, they're going to change it, and I need to preserve that website. Now, in the past, a lot of times what we would do is we go to the website, we hit print or convert to PDF, and say, well, we preserved it, right? Now, that could work in some instances, but Page Vault is a company that basically preserves that information in the way that it looks. Because if you go to a website and you hit print, it probably doesn't look like what you see on your screen, what the printed version. Page Vault ensures that it looks exactly the same way it's supposed to look. Plus, they're a third party that can authenticate the fact that they did this preservation. They give you a cover page with the date and timestamp. And anyway, you can go to pagevault.com. You can check it out. Obviously, you've done that, Neil. And you can even, you know, they'll give you an estimate of how much it would cost for them to preserve some of this aspect. And I talk about social media there from the preservation aspect, right? I know all of us go from an investigative standpoint. We all go online to do our, you know, a Google search, and we looked at LinkedIn for the opposing counsel and information like that. That's more an investigation. But this is like preserving that information there. So Page Vault is great. I'm going to throw another one out that Chelsea and I have really gotten to know the developers of a product called CaseFleet. Just like it sounds, CaseFleet.com. It's a former attorney, and I think his wife was an attorney as well, Chelsea. They developed this online SaaS platform where it can do some discovery. But frankly, I call it more of like a case analysis tool. Neil, I don't know if you ever used CaseMap back in the day. This was like a database platform where you could keep track of all the characters involved, all the people involved. You want to create a chronology of the events. And of course, each event you want to tie to a particular document, for example. That's exactly what CaseFleet does. And CaseMap was a very old program from the early 90s that worked great because it was a standalone. But today, just like Chelsea was saying earlier, the ability of cloud-based tools and SaaS products just make it amazing. Number one, Mac users like us, Neil, can use it. Windows users can use it. We can access it on an iPad, for example. We have all this information together at one place. CaseFleet is another excellent product. And then if we want to get into the actual e-discovery tools, or pretty much what they come down to is document review tools, right? Have a place where you can store the information. It processes the data for you. It preserves that information, allows you to review that information, and ultimately to produce out whatever is relevant and not privileged or confidential, right? So a couple of the big names today is Logical, LogicCull, logical.com, who are just really doing a great job of even getting some funding. Andy Wilson, one of the co-founders of Logical, just did a great podcast with Bob Ambrosi. Not as good as this one, of course, but he just went through the whole idea of why they started it and how they got into that platform. That's a cloud-based tool, again, accessible from any type of computer or mobile device. Another one that I've worked with for a long time is Lexbe, L-E-X-B-E. It's a company based out of Texas, but they were one of the first to be a cloud-based tool. And little more simplified in the user experience,
okay,
which means a lot of people like it, right? In other words, it's not that high end, really nerdy. You got to be a computer scientist to understand the interface here. But Lexmi.com just lets you get in, do a search of your documents and find what you need and then mark them. Even Thomson Reuters of Westlaw fame, right? They've about 2 years ago or 2.5, 3 years ago, they released a platform called eDiscovery Point to basically compete with these cloud-based tools. And then the last one quickly, I'm just going to mention is a fun name, Digital War Room, just like it sounds, yeah, Digital War Room. I
love that name.
I know, it's great. Well, what I like about them is I still have some firms that for a variety of reasons cannot use a cloud platform, either because they're, you know, regulation prohibits them with the information they're using or whatever the case may be. Digital War Room is still one of the companies that provides a desktop-based version of their software.
Oh, okay.
Now, they do have cloud options, but I keep these for a lot of the a lot of these firms that I work with that say, you know, we're not quite ready to go to the cloud. We need something that we can tell our clients, you know, is only used in here. It's very secure in our firm. And Digital War Room is one of the companies that offers that. What I like about Digital War Room is that you can get a desktop or you can go cloud. And basically, you know, depending on your needs, or if you start with a small case, you can do it on your desktop. But then ultimately, just like every case, it's going to blow up with the amount of information that you have. So then you can migrate up to their cloud server when you need to share information with outside folks, or you know, you just get too many emails that can handle on your desktop. So hopefully that's a little bit of a taste. We did about 32 reviews in last year's eDiscovery Buyer's Guide. We're not going to quite have that many this year, but just like Chelsea has said, we focused on even providing short video reviews of these products so that people can see it instead of just reading about it, and a little bit more on the interest of some of the other articles that we're including in this year's version.
And the tools that we mentioned here, we'll have them noted in the show notes. Are they applicable or appropriate for solo and small firm practitioners, or are they only for the big guys?
Absolutely. The mid-size and small, just like Chelsea was talking about earlier, that was our focus. We found that was the gap, yeah. Neil. Again, you know, I used to be at a firm of about 420 attorneys, and I did eDiscovery internal there because they hire full-time litigation support professionals to handle a lot of this, right? And they're good. In other words, a lot of those large firms, they have a litigation support department that they handle all this. They have bought lots of software to handle this internally. But it's that mid-size, you know, under like 150 lawyers, right? Even to the small folks. In fact, a lot of the people that come to us today are what boutique litigation firms, right, Neil? Yeah. In other words, these are maybe litigators that were at very large firms. They didn't want to be at the large firm anymore. They started their own firm and they may only have 2 or 5 or 10 attorneys, but they know because of their background and their experience that they need to use these tools to be proper in what they're doing from a litigation standpoint. And so even those small firms can absolutely use a lot of these tools. And just like Chelsea was saying earlier as well, some of them have some excellent price points that can allow you to start at least, you know, and just get a comfort level with either whether you want to keep the cost internal, or in many cases today, we're seeing a lot of people will pass that cost along to their clients. Yeah. Usually it's a per gig, per month type of a cost, but I see some companies now doing a user license cost instead and experimenting with some other ways to kind of keep those costs low.
All right. Well, hey, Chelsea, why don't you tell everybody how they can go about getting a hold of the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide?
Absolutely. So you can go to ediscoverybuyersguide.com. There's a button right there. It'll take you to our Learning Center where you can download a copy of last year's edition, a sign up for the release of this year's edition, which is happening imminently, and also subscribe to our YouTube channel, the eDiscovery Buyer's Guide YouTube channel, where Brett is always posting new highlight summaries as well as recordings of our webinars.
Well, I've got my work cut out for me and my viewing pleasure set. Now that Game of Thrones is done, I can, you know, I can geek out on the Buyer's Guide video channel. So, guys, we went on a little longer here than normal, but I think this is really important. Again, for my own, you know, 90% of why I do this podcast is for my own education. I mean, let's be honest, you know, and if somebody gets smart along the way, that's great. So you've educated me on the importance of e-discovery and how I have to start and pay more attention to it and the tools that I can use to help make that possible. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of the day to be with me. And I want to thank you again for being on The Law Entrepreneur.
Okay, Neil, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things that I find is that if you do even get a comfort level with this information, it can be a differentiator for your firm, right? If you're looking at it from that entrepreneurial side, which is what I love so much about your podcast, you know, it does make you a differentiator. Some people may not like it. Some people may say, why are you pushing this? But the fact that you can go to your clients and say, listen, we have taken the time to educate ourselves. In fact, I'm just doing an eight session boot camp with a law firm that was just reaching out for, like, similar to what Chelsea was talking about earlier. Like, we need to have some kind of an education on this so that we can be more competitive in the environment, right? In the sense we can go to our clients and say, we know how to handle this kind of stuff, and that can be a differentiator in the marketplace.
Well, the analogy that I see is, you know, 5 years ago, maybe a little longer, the attorney who came into the courtroom and was able to do a presentation before the court as opposed to drawing on the easel.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Same kind of differentiator.
Yes, sir.
And Chelsea, you were going to say, we interrupted you there briefly.
Oh, no. Thank you very much for having us. I mean, your podcast is a tremendous resource. And just as we would recommend that people sign up and subscribe to get news and be aware of what's happening in the e-discovery world, same is true for your podcast. Well, it's a tremendous resource, especially for anyone who's looking for just that quick digest of how they can better their practice, how they can achieve their goals, solutions and exposure to thought leaders like Brett. You really have built a tremendous following, and we thank you so much for having us on today.
Well, I appreciate those kind words. They're probably a little overly done for me, but I do appreciate it and greatly enjoyed having the two of you once again on the reunion show of The Law Entrepreneur. Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, Spotlight Branding, Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.